For nearly half of Americans, the wounds left by this year's divisive presidential campaign are still fresh, and some are worried about how much that will create some awkward Thanksgiving dinner table conversations.
Our meals will be restricted to conversations about family and food and giving thanks, however we give thanks, and to check the political discussion with your coat. That's going to be a challenge, I think, for a lot of people, but that's certainly what my plan is.
We'll hear from food writer Alyssa Altman. Social worker Joe Minarek will also give us some tips. Plus, a new study by Illinois researchers may help with the growing demand for food by increasing the productivity of one of the world's most important crops, soy.
I think what this paper brings to the table is food demand, water demand, and climate change. Something that we are thinking now, will it be valid in a future climate?
And we talk with one of Illinois' biggest pumpkin farmers. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. With Thanksgiving Day just around the corner, many of us are traveling, reuniting with family, and sitting down for large, elaborate meals. With those meals comes conversation with family and friends who, how should we say this, may have political opinions that are different from our own. I feel like this is something lots of families are talking about, worrying about, or in some cases we're already seeing some very public social media spats that are happening between families on Facebook. So what's going to happen when everyone's finally in the same room together? Should you talk about it? Should you, as some families have already said, no politics allowed, especially this year? What is the best way to approach conversations with our loved ones this Thanksgiving? If you have questions about this, this is what we're going to be talking about now. If you want to share a story, you can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. The handle is 21st Show. The person who's going to help answer those questions is Joe Minarek. He's with the University of Illinois' Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Relations. He recently, last week, gave a seminar that was open to the public. It was called Talking with Racist Uncle Joe, an interactive exercise on discussing race with families. Our producer, Sean Newman, went to the seminar last week and put together this piece of audio. Let's take a listen to hear how it went.
So the scenario is this. Thanksgiving is coming. We're going to be going and hanging out with friends and family. Of course, there is this guy that comes every year, good old Uncle Joe, and he is bound and determined every year to share his latest racist joke. So the question is, what are the varieties of ways we might be able to intervene or interrupt or challenge Uncle Joe in this context?
In a very real way, in post-election, it feels like there are a lot of actual lives at stake of people that I care about deeply.
Reasons why I talk about risk is because I do not want to promote some sort of naive message. But all you got to do is go out there and, you know, and all of a sudden people will welcome you with open arms and say, oh, I'm so glad you shared that with me. Thanks so much. We have to get smarter than that.
I mean, you could risk ruining the whole holiday for everyone because it's now Thanksgiving dinner is tainted with this big argument.
I'm Hannah. I feel a lot more prepared. I had gotten sort of a basis, but this really helped. I mean, in the class we sort of learned that, you know, emotions can run high, and that's generally not the best way to approach conversations with so much tension already, but this gave me a lot more insight to how to actually have the discussions.
And I say let's be completely conscious, completely cognizant, that what we're talking about is not simple. And we shouldn't think about it simplistically. We should take all of this stuff in and think smarter and think more sophisticated.
Thanks to Sean Newman for putting that together for us. And thanks to everyone who attended that seminar, being willing to share that with our audience. Joe Minarek, who led that conversation, he's a social worker who's in studio with us now to talk more about this. Everyone who went to your seminar, Joe, had a chance to learn a little bit more. We're hoping you can share that with our 21st audience. Welcome. Thanks for being here in studio with me.
Thank you.
Your seminar is something, you've been doing this for a couple of years. How did you first come up with the idea to frame this around Thanksgiving dinner conversations?
I worked at the YWCA in Columbus, Ohio, as initially the coordinator and then ultimately the director of the Anti-Racism Race Relations Project. And it was a really interesting opportunity for me to work with a lot of different folks, different communities, faith communities, folks within nonprofit organizations, county and state-level bureaucracies, and we were using racism study circles as the primary way of getting people together over a period of time, like five different sessions, to look at the issue of race in a productive, sort of instrumental way. And one of the things that came up that wasn't really covered by the curriculum we'd been using was this issue of how to actually talk with other people about, you know, when they make interesting comments, racist comments, for example. And it kept on coming up over and over again when I was in this position. And so I realized that it was an opportunity to kind of, again, be much more pragmatic and focused on helping people develop some skills and capacities around interacting with other people who make statements that are disagreeable, inappropriate otherwise. So over time, I modified it. And one of the issues that I kept on coming up with is that a lot of folks who do sort of diversity work, social justice education, things like that, have in the past kind of minimized the complexity of talking with other people about really contentious issues like race and racist comments. There's been this sort of message that all you need to do is go out there and say something, and you know that's what good activists do. And what I realized was that it was too simplistic a prescription. What we really needed and wanted to do was invite people to explore the very real risks of saying things that other people might find challenging or, you know, confrontational. And by unpacking some of the risks, you know, my perspective was, well, let's give people an opportunity to be kind of fully kind of conscious of what they're taking on in the moment. So that was where really unpacking risks of doing things and also the risks of not doing something or saying something came to the fore.
Well, and I think it's obviously these are awkward conversations, whether it's, and I imagine, do you feel like there was more interest this year in what you're doing because of how divisive this election has been and everyone worried about maybe having just really difficult conversations with other family members?
I think that's certainly the case. Again, I created this exercise back in the late 90s.
Right. And you created this for specifically about racism. And
yes.
Today we're talking about not just that, but also just difficult, kind of awkward conversations with people who have differing opinions than yours.
Correct. And it can be used for any kind of addressing any sort of social identity based comment or statement. But certainly, you know, people, I think part of the challenge for us is staying engaged with other folks, people that we care about, people that we have relationships with. You know, we see these things as kind of being put at risk when somebody makes a comment that we disagree with. So part of the challenge is what are the things that we're doing, recognizing that folks aren't probably always going to agree with us, especially when we get together maybe for, you know, two or three times in a year. How can we kind of prepare ourselves to address those situations that are pretty, you know, highly probable.
Right. And the risk, I mean, obviously, they're awkward conversations. They're difficult conversations to have. And then is the risk, as you said, you mentioned risks, like one woman who mentioned, everyone is always worried about, what if you're the person who starts the big fight that ruins Thanksgiving, right? And so as people start to think about having these conversations, how did you address, first of all, that concern? Like, just people worried that speaking up will just start a huge fight?
Well, I mean, quite frankly, that's a possibility that I think we need to be clear about. So it's not as if I have a magical answer for kind of a, you know, keeping the family peace. I think a lot of folks, once they start talking with each other and asking each other for strategies and thinking out loud about how to approach these sorts of issues, we'll come up with some very interesting interventions. So one individual actually mentioned something about contact the host beforehand and see if they can kind of come up with a set of guidelines or ground rules. You know, we're not going to talk politics during the dinner or something to that effect, so that that person can kind of take leadership. And again, this is being proactive rather than reactive.
I guess it's not too late to do that for this Thanksgiving, right? Send a quick email, text message. What's the plan for dinner?
Exactly right. Exactly right. So again, being proactive is one of the ways that I think of how do we work smarter around some of these issues. Again, recognizing that there are going to be people around the table that we don't agree with or are really directly opposed to in terms of their positions and ideas and attitudes, rather than leaving that to chance or, you know, to us kind of keeping our cool throughout the moment, are there ways that we can set things in motion beforehand?
So one of those is contacting the host, kind of figuring out what ground rules are. What are other things you want people to think about beforehand, before they get to the actual conversation, before they get to the dinner conversation, before they get to someone's house? What are, and it's interesting because I think in some cases I've even seen conversations of people having fights right now on Facebook and saying, well, we're going to talk about it when we're all together in person.
Well, I think there are a couple of things that I think are imperative for preparation, if you will. I like the idea of scripts. I like the idea of knowing and practicing what you're going to say to someone beforehand, in part because then you don't have to rely upon sort of, you know, by the seat of your pants coming up with something thoughtful and accurate, I guess. So practicing, developing a script and practicing it, talking it out loud with somebody else beforehand is, you know, potentially useful. I think the other issue is, again, how do you set yourself up so that you're actually interested in and motivated to listen rather than win an argument or win a debate? So the disposition that you have going into it, I think, is a big deal. I think one of the things that we're noticing around the political kind of context is that a lot of people feel as if they're not being listened to, haven't been heard. So how do we signal that we're actually listening, not necessarily with the idea in mind of figuring out where the holes are to the argument, but actually listening to understand somebody, where they're coming from, what their value priorities
are. Do you just say that? Do you just say, I really want to understand? Because the thing is you, I guess you also have to believe it when you say it too,
and if
right?
If you don't, then know that about yourself as well, right? I mean, this is part of the issue, being prepared. Like, what are you really wanting to do?
So maybe asking, what do you really want to get out of this? Do you really want to reach an understanding with someone or...
Yeah, win an argument or something like that. And in the work that I do at the university, the program on intergroup relations, you know, we're bringing students together to use dialogue as a way of making sense of really complex issues like race or sexual orientation, disability status, social class, liberal conservative political ideology. And that whole approach of using dialogue is basically saying, you know, our aim is not here to win an argument or a debate. Our aim here is to actually situate ourselves so that we're listening to other people who probably come at things in some at some points in a way that complements what we're thinking, but also diverges from what we're thinking. And how do we hang in there long enough so that we can actually hear and listen to people, so that we can actually maybe even have our own thinking changed or altered or, you know, elaborated upon in that process? But again, this means trying to figure out the motivation of the other person as well. And so the simpler scenario for me is, you know, when people are coming up with racist jokes, and, you know, these days, at least I thought it was safe to assume that social norms have changed around racism and, you know, making racist comments. The scenario that I created was one that was aimed at kind of creating a relatively simple kind of issue. Racist comments are bad. So now how do we deal with that?
And do you think we're do you think that we're in a different norm now where some people might even say, but that wasn't what I said, was what I said wasn't even racist?
Yeah. Well, and this is one of the fun sort of things to think about. I don't necessarily think that saying, oh, what you said is racist is necessarily the best way to approach those kinds
what
of issues.
What did you say?
Well, I might say so. Say more about what you just shared. You know, actually, one of the interventions that somebody came up with at one of the workshops last Wednesday, you know, it was the question. So say more about that. What exactly do you mean by X? And again, it could be seen as sort of a rhetorical trick, but it could also be, well, just help me understand what your thinking is and what's going on in that little thing that you gave, racist joke, racist comment, whatever. So helping, you know, kind of deconstruct it without getting upset necessarily. Can do a couple of things. It can actually, if the person, you know, in this case, the relative, family member, even colleague, didn't really know what they were talking about and the impact of that, this approach actually might help unpack that for them. Also, people around who are witnessing the exchange, who might not be sure why you're bringing up the issue, could also hear maybe more so what's problematic about something that somebody just said. So again, there's an opportunity for getting more information on the table, not only for the person who made the comment, but people that are witnessing, you know, the sort of exchange.
I'm speaking with Joe Minerick. He's a social worker. He's been talking to us about difficult conversations that we have around family and Thanksgiving, especially this year. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455 if you want to join us with a conversation. Let's go to a caller. It looks like we've got Heather in Champaign who wants to share a story. Hey, Heather, welcome to the 21st.
Now, thanks. I just wanted to share my typical Thanksgiving story. My mom is very left, and my dad is very right. And, you know, anytime politics comes up, it gets kind of ugly because my mom is very, you're being ridiculous. She actually likes using the word retarded. And then my dad is all, no, whatever, and then he just gets upset, and then it's all very awkward. And I heard him telling us that we should say, you know, things like, oh, tell me more about that and that kind of thing. And I think my parents just get so emotionally involved that they just aren't even in a place where they can say, hey, tell me more about that.
Because they're fighting with each other, it sounds like, too.
Yeah, and they've been doing this for, I don't know, like 45 years or something. So it's just their thing. But this year, we flat out said, okay, you know what? You're coming for Thanksgiving. There's a moratorium. You are not saying a word. Nobody's even making a jab. We're not even going to hint about either side of the situation because, of course, it was such a crazy election. So we don't even want to go there.
Thanks for sharing that story, Heather. I mean, we're gonna have to take a break we're going to take a break now. So when we come back, Joe, if you can respond to that, to Heather's story. And obviously it's an interesting one, right? Because it's her mom and her dad who are fighting in front of everyone else. If you have a story you want to share, if you have a question you want to ask, you can call 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show, 21st Show. We'll continue this conversation about difficult family conversations around Thanksgiving just after the break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanksgiving is 2 days away, and while everyone is doing lots of preparation for food and family and traveling, we're trying to prepare you for how to have perhaps awkward or difficult conversations, especially in light of this election and how divided we are as a country. We know that families maybe don't share political opinions, all of them, and so we're talking about how to deal with that. My guest is Joe Minerick. He's a social worker. He works with the University of Illinois Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Relations. Last week, he did a seminar on this for folks at the university. We were talking about things that came up there. We've got callers if you want to share a story, or if you have a question for Joe, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Just before the break, Joe, we were hearing from Heather in Champaign, who were talking about her parents married for 45 years. One extremely liberal, one extremely conservative, and how much they are fighting with each other all the time about this. And her rule was just, okay, we're not, she's already set the rule, it sounds like, they're not going to be having that any political conversations at the dinner table.
Right, the moratorium.
Right.
Which, again, I think, you know, if that's what you need as a family to kind of move from point A to point B, that's great. One of the challenges, and again, I think about this as a white person looking at issues around race, and racism, I think part of the challenge is developing the capacity to kind of work with other folks wherever they might be in terms of their own perspectives on really contentious, complex issues. And as I've been thinking about some of the folks I've talked with over the past week and before that, I think part of our challenge is, you know, as a white person, I've had to learn skills on how to address really challenging comments from family and friends and colleagues and strangers, other white people, for example, around the issues of race. And that wasn't something that I necessarily could think back on and, gee, how did mom and dad deal with
it? Right. It wasn't necessarily something was modeled in your family.
Exactly right. And I think this is one of the things that's an imperative for us. I think on the one hand, you know, we make choices about who we're going to hang out with, and we might do that for various reasons, including being more comfortable with some folks, less likely to get into arguments, et cetera. So we kind of start to surround ourselves with folks who kind of think like we do. But then we're also talking about, what about the next generation, the kids around us, the young people? If they're not seeing us engage with, again, divergence of perspective, people from various angles on different issues, including race or politics, then chances are they're going to follow the same sort of pattern of, again, surrounding themselves with people who think like they do, et cetera. They won't have models of how to work through issues and still stay engaged, still maintain, maybe even enhance the relationship, you know, folks have with others. So the insularity, I think, of people surrounding themselves with people who think like them, I think is a big issue for us and something that we shouldn't take lightly, especially white people dealing with issues around race. I think it's an imperative that we try to practice and develop our own skills, for example, around talking with people regarding race issues and contentious stuff, and have young people around us, kids, nieces, nephews, notice how we attempt to handle and struggle through that stuff.
We had we talked to some of the people who attended your seminar last week, and they had some questions you weren't able to get to during the discussion hour. Let's hear from one of them.
My name is Dinah Armstead. Joe has a wonderful exercise that I really impressed by, Racist Uncle Joe. I decided to come today because there's just so much that's needed, and I'm always looking for tools for better communication. How can you start a dialogue with someone who's more complacent? You know, if you ask them, they would say that they support equal rights and so forth, but still, you know, is there a role that they can play in society today? Well, how should they mobilize? What should they be doing?
So how do you, I guess, Dinah's central question, how do you, if you want to engage someone who, as she said, is more complacent, how do you do that?
That's a great question. I think that the developing, cultivating a sense of urgency personally is one thing. How do we also cultivate a sense of urgency for others? That's another kind of challenge. Part of it for me, you know, means trying to understand what, you know, where this other person's coming from, what their value priorities are, what their big concerns and beliefs are, the things that they hold near and dear, and to what extent are those things being threatened, perhaps outside of their own knowledge. And so bringing that kind of information, you know, the severity of situations, the issues, it might be stories that people haven't heard, but, you know, if they start hearing these stories and hearing them from folks that they trust and, you know, kind of recognize as in support of them as people, as human beings, hopefully that stuff will start to kindle a sense of concern that could be, you know, again, lead to the sense of urgency and move them away from complacency. I think the other issue, and this is one of the things that happened a lot with our with the workshops I was providing last week, a lot of folks are also trying to figure out, now that things are becoming more salient, how do they plug in? What organizations are out there? What's going on in Champaign-Urbana that they can actually tap into, things that people have already been working around for a while? And I was fortunate to have some colleagues on hand who knew, you know, what's going on in the community. But that's another thing that, you know, again, once you kindle this sense of urgency, I think it's imperative that that be sort of an opportunity to plug people in and get support and get an opportunity to going from thoughts and feelings to action.
Do you think that you have, after last week's presentation, another student asked about whether or not we should approach conversations with family and friends differently than we would with strangers. Do you think there's a greater sense of responsibility or incumbency you think we have to engage our family members than we would maybe with someone who is a coworker or even a stranger?
It's a great question. I love the fact that people are thinking strategically. Does having a relationship with someone make a difference? And I say yes, absolutely. With strangers, we might not be able to go much further than simply saying, you know, X is not appropriate. This is not cool, whatever that might be. With family members, with friends, with people, you know, whom we have a relationship. This could even be coworkers, by the way, because those are relationships. We have context. And there's an opportunity to do things with people that we have this context that are really quite different. We can listen longer. We can come back to things over and over again. We can kind of integrate these questions and issues and thoughts into future conversations as part of our relating, right? even with coworkers, you're going to be seeing this person, you know, tomorrow, next week, the week after, the month after, the year after. And actually, this is one of the things that I thought was really useful in terms of working with any sort of organized effort around helping people develop the capacity to think and talk about race. For example, working within organizations is a perfect venue because, again, people are going to be hanging out with each other over time. They'll be able to support each other's thinking, ask good questions, say, I'm not really sure, let me get back to you on that, and actually come back to it and build capacity over time within the organization.
And I think the interesting thing about that, Joe, and it's so interesting to hear you, you know, you're saying you're a white man, this is how you approach things. As myself, as a female person of color, as a brown person, I have to be honest with you and say a lot of times, especially if it is in family or friends, and if it is a coworker, I kind of make a calculation in my head. Is it worth it to have a conversation with someone?
Absolutely.
So I always do that. And I think oftentimes I know that's not an uncommon move for me to make, to think, is it really worth it for me to even have a conversation with someone about this? I wonder what your response is to that.
Well, so this is a great question. It's part of what I've integrated into the exercise. We have to be, I think, really thoughtful, very careful and strategic about engaging with other people. And there's a concept that I just came across recently in an article called differential vulnerability. But the idea here is, you know what? Social identities matter in terms of having conversations or confronting people, etc. And we need to be very, very intentional about that as well. So as a white male, people see me differently than they might a woman of color. And so if the issue is confronting or intervening or bringing up the issue of race to another white person in a position of leadership, for example.
Yeah, and sometimes, frankly, I get tired of it.
And absolutely.
Right.
And so part of it is if you were, as a woman of color, interrupting, challenging, et cetera, even in a relatively liberal group, right? The person who's being confronted might initially say, oh, thanks, Nyla. It's Nyla, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Nyla. Really appreciate it. But how many times do you do that to him before he starts seeing you kind of as, you know, a pain, right? A sore point. And with that, you start risking things as a woman of color in that space, including things like marginalization, kind of, you know, being dropped from the email list, maybe not invited to the party because, you know, she's always talking about that kind of stuff. You become a buzzkill. Now, as a white male, you know, liberal, if I'm really interested in dealing with things like racism, I need to be cognizant that the person, you know, another white person saying something that's race goofy, that's how I kind of call it, they're actually going to be more responsive if I give them the critical feedback as a white person versus if I were a person of color. So strategically, I'm going to use that to say, well, I have a better shot at actually affecting the person making the comment than someone else does.
So you're saying white people, this is more, it sounds like what you're saying is it's more incumbent on white people to have conversations with other white people about
strategically, this. Strategically, and by the empirical literature, it's saying, look, white people will listen to other white people and give them more credibility in their minds about this kind of intervention than people of color. And that's a big deal if you are concerned about dealing with, you know, racism, racist comments, etc. So strategically, it makes complete sense to go in that direction. I don't know how that maps onto other issues like sexist comments and gender, you know, homophobia, etc. But again, I think strategically, we need to think about our own positions, how people probabilistically will think about us, and how they'll listen or not listen based on those identities. And I think people also need to take care of themselves. So people who are more vulnerable because of social identity stuff, I don't know. I think sometimes don't step up, don't necessarily say things because you've got enough to handle. I mean, that's how I kind of think about it.
As you think about that and we think about everybody, no matter what color you are, going to preparing for this week, preparing to interact with family or other people who are close to them. One thing that was really interesting to me about the way you did your seminar was you didn't just lecture to people for an hour. You had people work in small groups. Why was it important for you to have people having their own discussions and coming up with their own? Because you aren't here saying, do this, do this, do this, and everything's going to be okay.
Correct. I really believe that we're smart enough to figure this out. And what I learn within 45 minutes typically of this kind of exercise, people who initially might say, well, there are two things that I would do. You know, either I'd blow up and yell at Uncle Joe, or I'd say nothing and feel like, you know, feel bad, feel awful, lots of regret. After 45 minutes of unpacking some of this stuff, what we find is, you know, 30, 40, 45, 50 different interventions that you might be able to choose from. And so I believe in the creativity of, you know, people when they get together and they start asking themselves questions and listening and exploring and brainstorming. I think we can come up with a lot of creative things. And I also think that doing it that way means you can go back home and maybe even before the event, you call up a couple of other family members and say, hey, you know, Uncle Joe, he always does this. What do you think? What are the options? How can we approach this? And so
you think everyone should be doing that now? Everyone should do that tonight, basically.
I think that would be a great idea. Again, you know, you feel out who else is in the family who sees this as maybe a concern. Maybe they're wrestling with the same sort of challenges and issues. Call them up and find out what they think. And again, support each other in coming up with some interventions that, again, they might be in the moment. They could also be even preemptive, you know? Who wants to call Uncle Joe and say, hey, man, can you kind of chill out this year because things are really, you know, in turmoil. Mm-hmm. So again, there are ways of thinking strategically and proactively, even beforehand and preemptively.
There was something that someone mentioned that you talked about in your seminar, and we mentioned this at the beginning of the conversation, which is these things are very emotional. People are, I think, on both sides, it's very raw. I think that what kind of advice do you have for people in terms of trying to kind of tamp things down?
Well, I like the idea of self-care. I think people taking care of themselves and really self-monitoring and noticing what kinds of feelings and thoughts are emerging, how prepared, how rested they feel to take something like this on, I think that's, you know, an imperative. What I've also suggested is that even though, you know, it might be a particular individual who's making the weird comment, it doesn't mean that necessarily what the only thing to do is to interact with him or her. Another thing to do is to talk with other people. For example, hey, what did you think about what Uncle Joe said?
Mm-hmm.
With young people, for example, people that are more ready to change and think about this stuff. So again, taking care of yourself might mean how much heavy lifting are you capable of doing at this moment. It could also be getting support, calling people up and, you know, telling them, hey, you know, I have this thing going on.
We just have a minute or two left. Sure. I want to go really quickly, if we can, to a caller, Mark in Springfield. Hey, Mark, we just have about a minute and a half left. If you can make your point really briefly so Joe can have time to answer.
Sure. I just wanted to say that I think, you know, these things are so contextual. And, you know, if you're in a group of, you know, a very conservative group and you're the one liberal person, or you're in a largely liberal group and you're the one conservative person, mm-hmm. or across race or social lines as well, I think that really depends on what your reaction is going to be, how uncomfortable you are, and, you know, where your brain goes on how to handle it.
Thanks for that comment, Mark. We just have about a minute left, Joe. Final thoughts on that, because I think Mark's point, it gets to your point about self-care, right, and kind of knowing when to say something or not.
It gets to self-care. It also says, well, what do I know about the people around me and how willing they are to engage versus simply debate? People who are willing to engage and to promote, kind of engage with each other, even with divergent thinking, you know, not being on the same page and listening, I think those are the folks that I would encourage folks to hang out with first and foremost and really figure out how to do that and build capacity around.
Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to everyone who called. Joe Manerick is a social worker at the University of Illinois. We didn't have time to play this. We'll put this up online, but we spoke with food writer Alyssa Altman earlier about her suggestions. We'll put that up online. We'll tweet it as well if you follow 21ST Show. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Scientists estimate by the year 2050, we're going to need to produce anywhere from 70 to 100% more food to feed an estimated 9.7 billion people. One of the biggest sources of protein in the world is soy, so it makes sense to figure out a way to make soybean plants more productive could have a big impact. And a team of researchers at the University of Illinois have just figured out that by removing a fraction of soybean plant leaves, you can actually give plants a boost in seed production by almost 10%. The new study has just been published in the journal Global Change Biology. Joining me now in studio in Urbana to talk about this are two of the researchers involved in the study. Praveen Kumar is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Illinois. And Venkat Srinivasan is a postdoc researcher. He's a postdoctoral researcher in crop science at the university as well. Professor Kumar, Venkat, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Professor Kumar, let's start with you, because soybean plants, people may not know this, there's a lot of leaves at the top of their canopy, and that in the wild helps make crops more resilient, but this also makes them less productive. Why is that?
So what our model and study showed is that because the way the plant is structured, there are a lot of leaves near the top of the canopy and fewer at the bottom, and they basically intercept the light at the top, and the light penetration through the canopy is reduced, and as a result, the canopy as a whole is less productive than it could otherwise be if we allowed the light to penetrate through the canopy.
And so in an agricultural setting, I guess farmers have enough, there's not really, I guess that's not necessary, the amount of leaves that are there for what would happen in the wild, is that correct?
Yeah, so what we are finding is basically that the plants which they have grown in the wild have grown to be far more resilient to environmental conditions, so forth, than what would be required in an agricultural setting. So they may be able to give up some of that resilience to increase the productivity. And mm-hmm. that's what Venkat's research was able to demonstrate.
And so, Venkat, the plants, when they're more productive, do they also use less water? Why is that?
That is right. So that's an awesome advantage. So leaves transpire, and photosynthesis and transpiration, which transpiration is the loss of water from leaves, is crop water demand, and they are a complementary process. So when you have less leaves, you need less water demand, and so basically you get more yield from the less leaves because of the better light efficiency, and you also use less water, thereby saving water and making them potentially drought tolerant.
So it's more light efficiency. It's not necessarily like less stress on the plant to have less leaves, and that's why it's more productive?
Well, so what happens if you look at a typical soybean crop, it have like about 6-7 leaves stacked one on top of each other. And so that's what they call as a leaf area index, which means you have how many leaves per unit land area. And so when you have leaf area of 6 or 7, it means you have 6 or 7 leaves stacked one on top of each other on an average. And so what happens is the top leaves get good amount of light. The top 2 or 3 leaf layers get good amount of light, whereas the bottom 4 leaves don't get much light at all. And so they are not photosynthetically efficient. They're not producing much photosynthesis to begin with. And so eliminating some of those shaded leaves is going to save some carbon for the plant that you can advantageously put to increasing seed yield. And also it saves on water. So that's the
right
benefit.
So you were actually out there physically taking leaves off plants. How did you figure out how many leaves and which leaves to remove? I imagine there was a lot of computer simulation that was involved with this as opposed to trial and error.
Yeah, that is right. So with Professor Kumar, we have a model called MLCAN. And so we use from the model, we got insights as to what the optimum leaf area for the soybean plant should be. And so that drove the field experiments. And so we had an army of undergrads like picking leaves in the middle of the day in the soybean field, trying to reduce the leaf area. And so, yeah, it was a mammoth effort, and I'm glad it turned out very well. So.
Well, and so you found that reducing the number of leaves was beneficial. To be specific, it was about a 10% boost in seed production.
That's right.
And then that's a 10% boost in seed production. Professor Kumar, I imagine it's not practical for farmers to do what Venkat was able to do, right? Because you were out there. I mean, farmers don't have a host of undergraduate, graduate students out there removing leaves by hand. Where does the research go from here now?
Yeah, so basically we have to figure out a way for the plants to do naturally what we try to do through manual effort, because, I mean, the genetic encoding in the plant is to produce what they did. And so we had to go and artificially cut down the leaves and demonstrate that this idea is actually workable and it will actually increase the yield. But now we have to, either through breeding or genetic studies, we have to actually get the plants to have those traits which we were trying to do manually.
Now, you wrote that increasing the yield of soybeans can solve the problem of protein demand and food production at the same time. So I wanted to take a step back and ask, we know that soybeans are among the most important sources of protein. It's certainly the largest source of vegetable protein available. What is the current situation in terms of how we know we started this conversation talking about, are we growing enough food to feed the world? Where are we at right now with soybean production and demand?
So if you look at historical trends for the past 30 years, we have on an average been increasing about 1% yield per year on an annual basis. But there was a recent paper that was published that projected demands in the future. And based on the past trends in increase in growth through crop,
population growth?
Population growth.
Okay.
So there's twin problems here. Just not more people. There's also more people with a higher income level, which need higher quality food, which means more protein food. And so it's not just more people demanding more food and just in terms of raw calories, but they also need better quality food. And so we are projecting that there's going to be more people above poverty line and kind of in the middle class. And so they demand, you know, and especially China and India with the booming population and a booming middle class, their food demands are drastically going to increase both quality and quantity. And that's going to place severe, you know, demands on food production in the future.
And so as we think about the Earth's population growing and, as you're saying, the demand to create not just more food but better food, what do you think this research means for helping solve the bigger challenges of food insecurity?
Yeah, that was one of the key drivers of our research because, you know, traditional crop breeding, crop technology was only giving us a 1% yield. Whereas if you look at projections in the future, we need 50 and 70% more by 2030 and 2050, respectively. And so that we are nowhere close to getting to that using traditional methods. And so we need kind of alternative disruptive strategies. And this is one of the strategy that we found out through, it was a modeling driven strategy. And so what we are trying to do is through either genetic engineering or, you know, maybe conventional breeding, but at a rapid pace, we can get to a desired canopy structure, optimize the canopy to boost yield. So I think this would, if not cover the entire demand in terms of increasing food supply, at least take us a long way towards getting there.
So I just wanted to add, I mean, I think a lot of the increase in food with production which we have got over the years has also come about because we have taken in more land for cultivation, but there is no such facility available. I mean, we are probably maxed out in terms of available arable land. So we really need a different strategy to increase productivity. And so this is sort of the first time when we are looking at the whole crop architecture as trying to provide us more leverage in terms of increasing productivity.
And underscores the need of how important it is for the future. Thank you so much for joining us. Praveen Kumar is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Illinois. Venkat Srinivasan is a postdoctoral researcher in crop science at the university. Gentlemen, thank you for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. Probably you're planning on pumpkin pie or some type of pumpkin on your table this Thanksgiving. Odds are that pumpkin was grown right here in Illinois. That's because we're the largest producer of pumpkins in the country. According to the USDA, to give you an idea, Illinois produced almost 750 million pounds of pumpkin in 2014. To put that in perspective, California came in second with about 200 million pounds. Sarah Fry just celebrated her 20th anniversary supplying pumpkins to Walmart. Her company or farm, Fry Farms, provided more than 26 million pounds of pumpkins just to Walmart just this year. And here's a fun fact. Over the last decade, Fry Farms has sold enough carving pumpkins to wrap around the world 7 times. That's a lot of pumpkins. Fry Farms is headquartered in Southern Illinois, although they have operations across 7 states. Sarah Fry, its founder and president, joins us now. Hey, Sarah, welcome to the 21st.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning. That is a lot of pumpkins that you all have grown. Where are they all grown? Are they all grown in Illinois?
Primarily Southern Illinois, Southern and Central Illinois, and also Southern Indiana, just across the Wabash River. So we actually farm in multiple states, but Illinois is our headquarters. and it's where most of the fall crops that we produce for both the fresh market and for processing fruits and vegetables are produced.
And so you, as you said, so you grow pumpkins for retail and for processing. Who do you sell your retail pumpkins to other than Walmart?
So we work with the top 25 retail chains in the country. So when you think of really anywhere that you would buy groceries, Walmart, Target, Whole Foods, Publix, Meijer, Kroger. So primarily what we grow for the fresh market goes direct to retailers. So we've had those relationships in place for many, many, many years. And we're able to sell our farm products direct to, you know, retailers even the size of Walmart.
Wow. Okay. And then your pumpkin processing, the pumpkin that you sell for processing, does that all get processed here in Illinois also?
It does. So our the pumpkins that we grow for processing are actually grown for the Nestle company, and they end up in what we all know is the Libby brand canned pumpkin.
Mm-hmm. I know earlier this year we checked in with a few central Illinois farmers. They thought it would be a decent year. What was the crop like, you think, this year for pumpkins?
You know, it was about average. We didn't have any major major shortages where we had to do a lot of outside purchasing, which is always a good thing for us. But, you know, the yields weren't quite as high as we would have liked to have seen. But, you know, all in all, it was probably about an average year.
Mm-hmm. Now, you guys are a big supplier of pumpkins, but that's not even the biggest thing you all produce at Fry Farms. What are your biggest crops this time of year?
The biggest commodity that we actually produce, and it's the lengthiest in the growing seasons because we actually start in Florida, is watermelons. So we grow watermelons in several states. Our season starts down in Florida, then it moves up through Georgia pre-4th of July. And then during the summer season, we have the Illinois and Indiana melons. And a lot of our watermelons actually end up in a product that we have called SAMMA, T-S-A-M-M-A, SAMMA watermelon juice. And we started making SAMMA a little over 3 years ago, and it's found in retailers like the Fresh Market, Publix in Illinois. It would be found in like a Schnucks store or, you know, the Fresh Market.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sarah, you run this company along with your family members, but you were 16 when you got into this business and 17 when you started selling watermelons to Walmart. How did that happen?
So when I, we actually grew up, I have four older brothers, and we grew up on a small family farm, just about 80 acres in southern Illinois. And in the summer, we used to accompany our mother on a melon delivery route. She used to purchase watermelons and cantaloupes from farmers across the river in southern Indiana. And she had a small delivery route of independent grocery stores that she would deliver that produce to. And as a little girl, I loved going on that delivery route because it was a way to get off of the farm. And so in the summer, I would help her. And my older brothers did at times as well. And as we kind of grew up, the boys went off to college one by one. And I was the youngest left sort of back at the farm. It was never really my intention to stay on the farm because, as you know, I mean, it's hard to make a living on, you know, on 80 acres of anything. So, but the summer that I turned 16, my mother actually went to work for a radio station. And, you know, the question was, were we going to discontinue the route? And I wanted to take over the route. So I used the family truck and took over and expanded the route that summer and built our delivery route from 12 to 150 grocery stores. So I started going further up into northern Illinois and all the way into the, you know, the St. Louis market, delivering fresh produce. And then I actually started delivering to Division I Walmart stores.
So wow.
That was sort of back in the day before Walmart had converted their smaller footprint stores that typically just carry general merchandise into what we all know now as
wow.
the Supercenter.
So, Sarah, thanks for sharing that. Unfortunately, we're out of time. But from that to you all producing such a significant amount of pumpkin for everybody, I want to say happy Thanksgiving to you. I assume you're going to have a lot of pumpkin at your Thanksgiving table, Sarah?
I have, we have pumpkin everything. Pumpkin savory, pumpkin sweet, pumpkin, you name it.
Right. Sarah Fry is the founder and president of Fry Farms in Wayne County. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about more food for our pre-Thanksgiving show. So stay tuned for that. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.